Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Harris, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Please sit.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's Wednesday, May 22nd, 2024, and we have five cases on our calendar today, three of which are scheduled for oral argument. As mentioned, I'm Judge Wheelock. I'm sitting today on a panel with Judge Harris and Judge Klopaki. And in case you're not aware, oral arguments are recorded by the court, including an audio recording that will be available on the court's website within about 24 hours. And additionally, we are holding our arguments today in courtroom 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. So with that, Marshall, will you please call the first case?
The first case this morning is A23-1449, In re the custody of BBFF.
And counsel, as you probably know, you will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a time keeping device, a clock on the center podium for you. Additionally, the podium does adjust up and down, so make sure you're comfortable with that before you start. And I would just ask that you introduce yourself and identify your client at the beginning for the purposes of our recording. And that way we also know how to pronounce everything. So, counsel, when you are ready, you may begin. There are 15 minutes on the clock.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jack DeWalt, DEWALT, appearing on behalf of respondents, Mr. Benjamin Drewley and Ms. Jennifer Drewley. Good morning to Judge Harris. Congratulations. Judge Klopaki, always a pleasure to see you. Presiding Judge Wheelock, good morning, counsel. May it please the court, I am asking the court today to overturn the district court's order dismissing the district court's decision to dismiss my client's third-party custody petition. The district court erred in a number of ways, Your Honors, but three primary ways are that it failed to consider A, required factors when making its decision under subdivision or statute 257C03 subdivision 7 subpart B as in boy. Two, it failed to find that appellants had met their burden of proof under 257C03 subdivision 7A, A as in alpha, and appellants had also held appellants to a standard of needing to show direct harm to the child when, frankly, that is not the law. Looking at the first issue, Your Honors, the district court was required to consider and make findings under 257C03 subpart 7B when considering appellant's third-party custody petition. I say that because the statute states the following factors must, and I emphasize, must be considered by the court in determining an interested third party's petition. Despite that language, Your Honors, no findings or consideration of those factors were made by the district court. And in fact, the district court explicitly held that it did not have to consider those factors under law. That finding and that holding was contrary to law.
Counsel, when we look at subdivision 7A, and it shows we have the and there, then, and that means we need to find both 1, 2, and 3. And then I believe the second one has to do with the best interest factors. Or sorry, maybe the other one. Don't we interpret the and to require that all three of those things must be shown? And if they're not, then we don't reach the other two?
No, Your Honor. In fact, no. There is some probably credible argument to be made whether or not best interest findings under 257C04 have to be made. I would argue they probably do, but I understand practically speaking, if the court finds under subpart 7A that it's not going to find by clear and convincing factors or evidence one of those three factors. But the section we're talking about, Your Honor, is specifically subdivision 7B. And 7B, again, in the case law states this, as cited by appellants, that it must be considered, and that's the language that the statute has, Your Honor, When reviewing a third-party custody petition under subdivision 7A, the court must consider these following factors. So, again, must is mandatory. It's a shall. Statutory construction tells us that interpretation is it must be considered. Now, arguably, again, I'm not trying to overstate my position in the sense that I understand some case law would say that as long as findings could have been made within the record, or as long as findings were made somewhere else that could be inferred into those findings, that that's sufficient because abuse of discretion is broad. I recognize that, of course. But with that said, Your Honor, this court made no findings and, in fact, specifically found it did not have to make those findings. That's problematic. That's highly problematic. And the reason that's problematic is A, it's against the law, again, under the plain language, unambiguous statutory language. But two, it states that if you had considered those factors, all of the relevant ones would have favored appellant's third-party custody petition, every single one. The amount of involvement the interested third party had with the child during the absence or during the child's lifetime, that's been my client's. Child went there after birth, went and lived with my clients. He stayed there throughout the proceedings and to this day. Two, the amount of involvement the parent had with the child during the parent's absence, limited. And it's limited by choice of respondent. Respondent was given the opportunity, and again, I'm not trying to distract from this argument, but respondent was given the opportunity to expand parenting time by Judge McPherson, simply provide a hair follicle test to prove that he is clean and sober, and the court was anxious to move him off of supervised parenting time. Did not happen. So involvement has been limited to the most part supervised parenting time. Facts and circumstances of parent's absence. Mr. Flemang chose to absent himself from the child's life. He left the state. He left the child in the care of appellants. So my point, I'm not trying to go through every single factor for the court here. My point is the reason these factors must be considered when reviewing the petition is they are informative to the three factors under subpart eight. And in this particular case, if the district court had done that, what would have happened is there would have been additional evidence, additional argument or inferences to be drawn that would support appellant's petition.
And
So,
what authority are you relying on to assert that the consideration of the factors that you're referencing are required to be found to inform the court's findings on the three factors in 7A1 about whether the parent abandoned or whether there was physical or emotional danger or other extraordinary circumstances? I guess I'm not aware of any case law that suggests that the best interest factors inform the court's assessment of the first three factors.
I'll respond to the case law, Your Honor, because I believe it's within my brief, but in my rebuttal, I apologize. But as far as the actual language of the statute, which is primarily what I'm relying upon, if the court looks at Minnesota Statute 5257 C03, it says, when reviewing a petition for interested third-party status, the court must apply Minnesota Statute 257 C03, subdivision say 7A, those are the three factors the court's referencing, and must also consider the following factors in Minnesota Statute 257 C03, subdivision 7B. So I would point principally to the statutory language that I'm relying upon, but there are case citations, and I will provide those on rebuttal, Your Honor.
Counsel, presuming your analysis of the statute is correct and this court agrees with you, why is the error the court committed not harmless error? That being because the court found that your client didn't have standing as an interested third party, why wouldn't it be harmless that they didn't make those additional findings for the statute?
Understood, Your Honor. Absolutely. And I certainly recognize harmless error is not a basis to overturn a district court's broad discretion. Having said that, Your Honor, the problem we have here is it's A, specifically required by statute. So this isn't, I would argue, this isn't discretionary with the court. It doesn't say the court may consider, it says the court must consider. Two, I think it's highly problematic when the court finds under subdivision 7A, you didn't meet your standard of proof, appellants, didn't do it. But I'm not going to consider these factors that I'm required to that actually would support your petition had I considered them as required by statute. So I would say this is the definition of not harmless error. I think this is mandatory requirements. This is mandatory language. This is not discretionary with the court. Now, arguably, the court could say, I'm not going to find every single factor here because the record relates and supports my conclusions. I understand that. That's not what happened here, Your Honor. So I do not think there's any possible, plausible way to argue that ignoring half of a mandatory requirement of a statutory analysis without any findings and explicitly saying I don't have to conduct that analysis is anything other than material and direct error.
It looks like the trial court characterized Subdivision 7A as a standing statute. Do you accept that proposition?
No, I don't, Your Honor. And the reason I don't is because standing, my understanding or definition would be that the appellants had a two-step process to move forward in their petition. One was basically make a prima facie showing of standing. Right. And they did that. That's the order that the court issued in September 2021, where it says, hey, I find extraordinary circumstances. Here's a factor. I'm not going to find other factors. We have standing to move forward. The burden of proof is really what I think the court is getting to under 7A, Your Honor. And I would personally, I just don't think that's a standing question. I think that's a burden of proof question. I think the court says you didn't meet your burden of proof under these factors. Ergo, your petition is dismissed. I will acknowledge, I think the record is muddy on this question, but in my opinion, having kind of considered this a lot, my perception would be standing was established under September 2021 order. Burden of proof was found to be lacking after the trial. So if the courts then move on to the next major question before the bench, which is Subdivision 7A. So the question then becomes principally these three factors, right? And I argue, and I think the evidence supports, every single factor has been met by clear and convincing evidence. Abandonment occurred. Mr. Flamang left the child in my client's care voluntarily and went to Wisconsin. There was no plan to return. There was no statement that was pointed to or shown anywhere that would say, I'm going to be retrieving the child at some point in time. He did that.
It looks like the trial court also, I don't know, focused on it, but at least commented on the fact that at least one of your clients yep. didn't believe
sure.
the child had been abandoned.
100%.
Is that something that is inappropriate for the trial court to decide that legal question based upon what a party characterizes the facts?
No, Your Honor. It's simply not. And the reason why is my clients are not a decision maker or authority under the law. Do I think that Mr. Flamang and my clients had a conversation? He says, I am going to abandon the child and go to Wisconsin. No, 100% no. That did not happen. Do I think that the definition of what occurred is statutorily defined as abandonment or could be statutorily defined as abandonment? 100%. He left the child with no plan to return in my client's care for an extended period of time on an open-ended basis. Again, it's critical that there is no intent or plan to return. So no, I recognize the district court's finding and saying, hey, your client said they didn't think it was abandonment, ergo it's not abandonment. I would challenge that finding. Two, I would say that there is also clear evidence of potential physical and emotional harm to the child. This is replete throughout the file, Your Honor.
Did you make a motion for amended findings in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Is that the district court also made much of the idea that there was not a direct harm to the child by Mr. Flamang. Literally reading into the statute, I would argue, a requirement of direct harm, which does not exist. This court has held, again, under Covington, as cited in my brief, reply brief, and then also just reading the plain language of the statute. It says the presence of harm has to exist. Mr. Flamang, to be, there's a couple points I probably just need to make before I leave, was convicted of felony assault for strangling my client's daughter to the point of strangulation while intoxicated with no recollection of that occurring until she urinated herself.
And that's the mother of this child.
Yes, Your Honor. Two, while living with my clients, he, under the influence, crashed the vehicle that she used to own. To the point that the responding officer was concerned for his safety, called my clients and would only release him into the recognizance of my clients because of concern of self-harm. Three, after moving to Wisconsin, he was again intoxicated, again convicted of that crime. And then four, while our trial was occurring. While the trial was occurring. So we had days here, then we had continuance days there. Mr. Flamang reports to jail. He is at that time, while the trial is occurring, under the influence of THC, which I understand, but also an opiate that is generally given to dogs for cancer treatment. So that's not even getting into the statements he's made under oath as to conditions from his past convictions regarding compliance or sobriety and the need for treatment. Those are facts that are within the record that happened during the case. So I would argue, Your Honor, again, I'm not sure exactly what is required under the district court's interpretation of the law other than a direct showing of harm. And the problem with that, Your Honor, is this child directly went to my client's care from birth. The reason he wasn't harmed in the car accidents, for example, is he wasn't there because he had abandoned the children or the child to be with my parents or with my clients. So the interpretation, and this is probably where I need to kind of conclude, that the law somehow infers or requires a showing of direct harm is A, 100% bad policy, contrary to every family law tenet I'm familiar with, but two, is completely contrary to the law that, as it stated. The Minnesota Supreme Court has made clear that the best interest of the child must be the overriding consideration in custody decisions and supersedes the parental presumption contained within 257C03 subdivision 7A, right? So the parental presumption, the constitutionally protected right to raise our children, always is superseded by the consideration of the children. As stated by that court, ultimately the welfare of the child is the umbrella under which every aspect of custody decisions, including the presumption falls. That's In Re Custody, NAK, a third-party custody case. So the court and our laws, and I see my time is up, exist to protect the children from harm. Asking this court to not make that the law, Braxton Drewley should not be directly harmed before he can experience the safety provided by both the court and our laws. Thank you, Your Honors, unless there's further questions.
I have one more question.
Yes, Your Honor.
It looks like the trial court had some concern for the ability of the father to take care of this child, but indicated that maybe this is a matter to be handled in Wisconsin. You want to react at all to that?
Certainly, Your Honor. Two things. One, the court does have that concern. That's what's kind of alarming to me, is if you, and I think this would be Mr. Flamang's arguments in the writs of prohibition to the court, once you find that this court is dismissing the third-party custody position, arguably you would say there's no jurisdiction over the child should be immediately returned to the parent. I think that's actually Mr. Flamang's argument in those motions or writs. The court says no. You provide a clean hair follicle test as part of a transition plan, which indicates concern. As to the issue of Wisconsin, Your Honor, frankly, once this court issued a child custody determination, which it did on a temporary basis, I think that meets the criteria under 518B as far as initial determination for custody purposes. I think Minnesota would retain that jurisdiction as long as the child was present within Minnesota, which the child remains present. Unless Minnesota were to waive jurisdiction over the child to Wisconsin, which Minnesota, of course, can do, Wisconsin would retain jurisdiction.
I have one more question, if I might.
Oh, certainly.
Well, this is not in the record, but trial court anticipated that something would occur before the custody would, in fact, be actually transferred to the father. Where's the child been since then?
With my clients, Your Honor, to this day, as of this morning.
So effectively, the child has been with your client for how long?
Since birth, Your Honor.
And that is? Help my arithmetic here. How long is it?
Yeah, I apologize. I think the child, and I'm going to ballpark this, is 3 or 4 years old at this time, Your Honor. And I'll certainly have that on rebuttal. I just didn't have that piece of information top of mind, Your Honor. But since birth to this morning.
Okay.
Thank
you, counsel.
You,
you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll reset the clock. And counsel for respondent, feel free to adjust the podium Please introduce yourself and your client at the beginning, and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. Heather Olson here today on behalf of Brock Fleming. I'm going to jump right in and respond to some of the arguments made by counsel, specifically with regard to the findings that counsel indicates that were lacking under 257C.03 subdivision 7 paren B. If you look at subdivision 7 paren A, there are the three factors that the court must find one of those three factors in order to move forward and the move forward with the petition. In this particular case, the court did not find any of those three factors and did dismiss the petition. If you go further into the statute, it then indicates under subdivision B that the following factors must be considered by the court in determining the interested third party's petition. At the point where the court had already dismissed the petition, there is no determinations to be made under that petition because it's dismissed. Further, even if we were to consider a subdivision B, the record is very clear that the court did make specific findings about these particular factors. She did not enumerate them. That is true. She did not enumerate them and make specific findings. But also, the statute says that she must consider in determining the interested third party's petition. It does not say that she must make findings on those particular issues. With regard to those particular elements, the amount of the involvement of the interested third party had the child during the, sorry, the amount of involvement the interested third party had with the child during the parent's presence and during the child's lifetime. The court did consider that. The court stated that in multiple orders that the child had remained with the Gerulis during his entire life. However, if we look...
So, counsel, you indicate that the court must consider, and the statute indicates that they must not make findings. How will this court know, or how do we know if this court or the court considered that information outside of findings? How do we infer that?
They're not enumerated in the orders, but there are findings in the orders that state these particular things. And with regard to the paren one under subdivision B, counsel has neglected some of the case law that indicates, and specifically with regard to, I have that case. Just want to pull it up. With regard to, it's the Kayakith case, as well as the Givens case, that indicates that when determining the substantial contacts that a interested third party has with a child, it must take into consideration the contacts to the extent that they are equitable. And in both of those cases, that indicates that it would be to at the point prior to the petition in this case, the petition. This child was under the jurisdiction of this court after he was 6 weeks old, based upon an ex parte order that was filed, and is still to this day the ex parte order is the prevailing order at this point. So the contacts.
That's because the dismissal, in fact, has stayed pending a transition plan.
This is true.
And the transition plan never occurred, so how long is this going to be in a stayed status?
Until the transition plan is tried before the district court. The ex parte order is what is
the effect prevailing. Of all of this is that this child has been put in a position that normally would result in termination of parental rights.
I understand that, Your Honor. And in terms of the findings of endangerment, there were no endangerment findings. All of these things, this child does need to be reunited with his father. The stay of the dismissal is something that we brought to this court's attention through writs, but there were other...
The trial court noted, too, that while these proceedings were going on, there were at least 20 occasions when your client didn't show up for a either planned or noted visitation.
Your Honor, I understand that that was part of the record, and there's also indication in the order that Ms. Giruli was the one who testified about that, but she also did not have specific dates and could not specifically identify why all of those were missed.
And the court indicated that your client had given no reasonable explanation for missing these as well.
He didn't give any reasonable explanation because he did not testify at trial. We moved for involuntary dismissal after the presentation of the petitioner's case in chief because they had not met their burden. And so my client did not testify or provide any information relative to that particular piece. As to going back to the whether or not subdivision B must be considered, we also need to look at subdivision 8 of 257C.03, which is about the dismissal of the petition. And it says the court must dismiss a petition for custody if the court finds, one, that the petitioner is not a de facto custodian, that's not relevant here, but two, the petitioner does not establish at least one of the factors in subdivision 7, paragraph A.
Tell me why leaving a child with someone, in this case a grandparent, for an extended period of time does not constitute abandonment.
It does not constitute abandonment because my client was under the purview of an ex parte order that stated he was to only have supervised parenting time. He had no...
Did he exercise that supervised parenting
time? He is
time?
Currently exercising that parenting time as we speak.
I'm not talking about now. I'm talking about before and at the time of the hearing.
My client has consistently exercised his parenting time. The trial court record is full of parenting time notes. That was a stipulated exhibit. All of those notes express no concern for my client in taking care of the child under the in his supervised parenting time. The abandonment.
So when did these 20 occasions occur that the trial court referenced?
I don't know exactly how many actually occurred, but
no,
I
when,
do.
When did they occur?
They occurred during from the time that my client was allowed to have supervised parenting time until the trial.
Under the temporary order.
Correct. And there are a number of reasons that those parenting time did not occur. There is evidence in the trial court transcript that there were weather-related issues, there were scheduling issues, things of that nature that necessitated, some of those parenting time being missed.
With the fact that the evidence showed a chemical dependency issue on the part of your client, what did the trial court do to protect the child against what might be a consequence of that?
The trial court did not even find that there was a chemical dependency issue.
I didn't say that. I said there was evidence in the record that there was a chemical dependency issue. Is there not?
There was evidence presented.
Or is he just an erratic driver that happens to be drunk when he's driving?
There was evidence presented of chemical use. There was a finding that there was not substantial evidence presented that would indicate that there was a chemical dependency issue. The trial court even indicated that the appellants did not request a chemical dependency evaluation, did not request any testing throughout the trial court process, did not ask for a psychological evaluation. Even when on cross-examination, when Mr. Giruli was asked about why he did not ask for this evidence, he said he did not know that he could. The fact that they did not present the evidence to meet their burden is the reason we are here. We are here because they did not meet their burden of proof. They did not do the appropriate discovery. They did not ask for the appropriate evaluations during the trial court process when they could have at any point in time. This record is very clear that there was multiple motions throughout this case before it made it to trial, or they could have asked for all of these things in order to prove their burden, which they did not do.
Counsel, it seems to me this is an interesting situation we're presented with because it's almost an inversion of what we usually see in cases where someone's arguing that. And here it's the grandparents are arguing that there are these concerns that would meet 7A1 where there's abandonment, neglect, concerns about physical and emotional danger, et cetera. In this situation, just help us understand, the child was born, the father left to take care of some legal proceedings that were occurring in another state. And it was during that time that the ex parte order was put in place. Is that right?
That is correct. And that is where I would like to address the abandonment issue, because during that, I believe it was about 15-day period where my client had gone to Wisconsin to address these legal issues, that's when the ex parte order was issued. During that time, and the record is clear of this, that Mr. Flamang was constantly checking in on the child, that he had made, that he was making phone calls and text messages to check on the status of the child. He had never indicated that he was going to abandon the child. At the point where an ex parte order was issued and served upon him, he had no reason to go back into the home of the Gerulis at that point. And so the 15 days is what they're claiming is an abandonment, which is not actually true, considering the fact that he was constantly checking in on this child, making sure that things were okay. He did it with their permission. And as the record indicates, they had indicated, both Mr. and Mrs. Drewley indicate, that he did not abandon the child. And if there is any argument for abandonment, well, I would say that there is no argument for abandonment, considering the fact that my client has been subject to this ex parte order since April of 2021.
Does the record reflect what the nature of his legal difficulties in Wisconsin were?
Mr. Flamang was on probation for the domestic assault. Also, I would like to correct the record. He was not convicted of a felony. He was charged with a felony. He was convicted of a misdemeanor and was placed on probation for that offense that occurred in 2019, prior to the child even being conceived. Also, that is a great segue to the actual harm argument that counsel makes. In terms of there being no direct harm to the child, the court did find that when there was a domestic assault, it was prior to the conception of the child, and that there is no way that she could infer that he would be a harm to the child based upon that particular incident.
So if these legal difficulties had taken place before the child was born, what did he need to do in Wisconsin after the child was born?
Because he received that DWI in the state of Minnesota, he needed to go and face the probation in Wisconsin and let them know that he had received another charge, and then deal with trying to make sure that those probationary terms were complied with. And to his credit, he knew he messed up, and he immediately went to go take care of it. And this is being used against him and as an abandonment.
He couldn't engage his probation officer in Wisconsin and take care of the child at the same time. Is that what he was suggesting?
He needed to be present in the state of Wisconsin to address those issues with his probation officer. So that's when he left to go do that. And then that's during that time. And the original ex parte order was 91 pages. There would have been some time that needed to be to put that thing together. So that's what was occurring while he was gone. I do know that I'm getting very close on time, so I do really want to address this direct harm issue. With regard to the direct harm, the court did find that during the time that he got the DWI and crashed the vehicle, the child was nowhere near him. The suicidal ideation was in the record. The deputy says he was very emotional. He had just lost his fiance. That was a lot of stuff that had gone on in those short period of time when that had occurred. The court did find that there is not any direct harm, But even further, it is required that there be a nexus. And that is what the court did not find. The court did not find that there was any nexus between his behavior and any actual harm to the child or any potential actual harm to the child, because that is what is required in order to determine whether or not, you know, abandoned or whether or not actual endangerment is there, as well as the fact that he never has abandoned the child. He has been consistent. Yes, he has missed some parenting time, but there were parenting times was missed for a variety of reasons. I'm out of time.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much. And we'll turn back to Attorney for Appellant for the final word. There are 5 minutes on the clock. Feel free to adjust the podium and begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Has this child ever lived in Wisconsin?
No, sir.
So this child has been in Minnesota for now 3 to 4 years, and your clients are claiming that there's a potential neglectful situation here. We have a child that's been placed without a, well, I guess there was a temporary order. Is this a situation where Minnesota authorities ought to have investigated it in terms of...
As far as if we're referring to county investigation, Your Honor, I don't know. I would, practically speaking, say, and a lot of times when there's a family court action, I don't think the county would likely get involved, practically speaking, Your Honor, under the assumption that the family court would have purview. The child was born on March 7th, 2021, Your Honor, to answer the question of how long has a child been there. I'd also kind of maybe working backwards. The nexus analysis, I think, is just simply incorrect. The nexus that's being referenced both by counsel and by district court is this idea that direct harm has to occur. That's not the nexus. The nexus is there a reasonable inference of harm to the child by the presence of these conditions? The answer is yes. And that's the court's case in Covington, which is that it is literally illogical, I think, as a policy statement to say, until a parent harms a child, we as a court system can't reasonably infer any harm from any facts, no matter how egregious. No matter what you do over there, if you didn't directly harm this child over here, we're not stepping in. We all know where that goes. We all know where those policy ideas take us, Your Honors. And I'm frankly, candidly asking the court not to do that. The nexus is there a reasonable inference of harm? The answer is 100% yes.
Why is it that you didn't engage in discovery and ask for some chemical dependency assessment and psychological assessment?
Discovery was extensive, Your Honor, and frankly, evidence is evidence. There is no dispute that Mr. Flamang has been to treatment, was in treatment, had multiple arrests or criminal interactions related to chemical use.
But is there any evidence that he's been using in front of the child or when he's been responsible for caring for the child or in a manner that has placed the child in danger?
Certainly, Your Honor. One, respondent lived with my clients and there's testimony that he used while living in the home with the child. Two, the first accident where he destroyed the mother's car was while living with the child. Again, the idea that the child needed to be in that car for us to say there's been harm, or the idea, frankly, Your Honor, and this is a highly problematic position, given the fact that the burden now becomes on my clients to not only care for the child, fight a legal battle, but pay for experts to prove a fact that really is undisputed of evidence in order to find harm or direct harm to the child, is creating a two-tiered system. Most people can't afford experts, as we all know. Most cases are pro se with both or one. And so the idea that my clients now are supposed to do that, frankly, I think is problematic at best, again. And I'll concede, Your Honor, in hindsight, given how big this issue has become, 100%, I would tell my clients, let's figure this out, let's get it done. The fact of the matter is the reason it wasn't done is because it's an undisputed fact.
But actually, I think the way I read the court's order, yep, is not even so much that there was competing evidence both ways and that the court made a credibility determination, which would you agree if that was the case that we would defer that we should defer to the district court's credibility determinations?
Of course, Your Honor.
But, you know, as I look at it, finding 18 or conclusion of law 18 states there is no evidence that his alleged lack of care rises to the level of abandonment, neglect, or disregard for the child's well-being. And then later in that paragraph, the visit notes from Mr. Fleming's parenting time with the child are positive and do not show any present neglect or disregard for the child's well-being. So I don't even see in the record that the court is saying we have, it's close call, but I'm siding with one side here.
I agree. I think it's completely illogical, Your Honor. Having reviewed hundreds of pages of supervised visitation notes, they rarely show a concern because they're supervised in a safety center. Secondly, I think, again, in fairness to Judge McPherson, I have a great amount of respect for Judge McPherson. She has to say something to support her decision. I recognize that. What I'd leave the court with is she didn't place this child with Mr. Fleming after dismissing the petition. She required a hair follicle test. So if the court doesn't have to necessarily agree with my arguments, even though I think the record is replete with information, this judge herself, after saying, I'm not going to make a finding of chemical or alcohol concern, says, but I'm not going to release the child into your care until you provide a hair follicle test, which hasn't happened today.
What are you suggesting, that that's an inconsistent position the trial court took?
I would say, logically, I find that to be an inconsistent conclusion, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Unless the court has other questions?
I don't see any.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and your arguments here today. They've been very helpful. This matter is considered submitted, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.